You are listening to the Signal to Noise podcast on the ProSound Web podcast network. Signal to Noise is supported by Audix. Check out their new line of Pro Studio headphones and A131 and A133 large diaphragm studio condenser mics at audixusa.com. Alan and Heath has asked us to read the following statement. Food for thought. The more holes you have in Swiss cheese, the less cheese you have. The more cheese you have, the more holes you have. Therefore, the more cheese you have, the less cheese you have. What a world we live in.
Welcome back to the Signal to Noise podcast. I'm Chris Leonard. Michael Lawrence, also known as Joe Mama right now, apparently on my screen. How's it going, Michael?
I'm good. You know, I sometimes miss the youthful enthusiasm of a good Jamama joke, so I'm bringing it back. I'm going to try to bring it back, you know, start a new trend.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep. And you know, as we were just chatting, we are creeping towards our 100th episode. We have, we're going to be doing a live stream on, it's May 5th.
Cinco de Mayo, May 5th. Yep.
We're going to be doing it live. We're going to have some special guests come by.
For the record, many people think we planned this on purpose, the whole like taco Cinco de Mayo. It just happened, I swear.
The universe has smiled upon our podcast. we have some fantastic prizes. Thank you to Alan Heath for they're giving away an SQ5 mixing console. Thank you to Audix. They're giving away a kick-ass microphone and headphones bundle. Both of them, I love those microphones in there, so that's really cool stuff. Thank you to Ethan Weiner for donating a signed copy of his book, The Audio Expert. Our resident musician here on the Signal Noise podcast, Mike Green, album download and a t-shirt from him. John Huntington got in touch with me over the weekend, and he has generously offered a copy of his new book, Introduction to Show Networking, and some merch from Deadmau5, who is the most popular Signal to Noise guest we've had so far. I got in touch with him, and he sent us, I believe, a Deadmau5 t-shirt you're going to get. So
and
head
we'll
over
definitely
to signalnoisepodcast.com, fill out the form.
Yeah, and we'll definitely be giving away some stickers or shirts or something else live for those who are participating live. So, yeah, make sure you tune in live.
We're giving out a date with Chad as well. So,
my wife's going to be mad.
So, this episode actually was Chad Olick's idea. He sent me a text and he said, "Hey, man, wheels are starting to turn again. People are starting to, you know, put staffing kind of probes out for shows and tours. And we have a lot of people who reach out to us through the Signal to Noise podcast mentorship program. Check that out on our website, on our Facebook page, and on our Discord. And they're interested in getting on tour. How do I get on tour? How do I land the gig? Am I qualified? What do I need to know once I'm on tour? How do I get paid? How do I do my laundry? All of that stuff. We're going to talk about that. So Chad said, hey, we should have a discussion about that. So Chad Olick, welcome back to the show. He's going to be our guest host for tonight. Kyle is playing his indoor soccer league, so Chad's gonna handle the proceedings. And we also asked our favorite monitor engineer that we've had on the show.
Perfectly fine.
Ms. Becky Pell. Yeah. She's joining us from the bottom of the world. She's down in Australia. So it's morning for her.
Hold on, it's evening for everybody else. I've been to Australia. Yeah. It's the other way around. We are on the bottom. Australia's on the top. It's stupid Americans think we're on top.
Are we upside down? Okay. All right. Yes. Fair enough.
I'll never forget.
Fair enough. Wonderful...
Do we have a delay issue going on?
Super latency, bro. It's like 10 seconds. It's just you.
I don't know how to change it. Anyway, so I'll never forget the first time I was in Sydney on tour, and I was like in a hotel lobby, and some Australians there. Like, mind you, this was 2008-ish. So Bush was still president, and he had just recently spoken at a conference, and he had misspoken and called Australians Austrians. So coupled with, you know, you know, in general, sometimes people from the States or the States are not looked kindly upon from other countries. And we're in the lobby talking. Obviously, our, you know, our accents are way different. And someone came up to us like, oh, are you from the States? And we're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And they're like, oh, we're sorry. And I was like, shit. I'm not. But I was like, it was a culture shock of like, damn it. Like, I had no idea. Anyway, so that was like one of my first experiences in Australia and Sydney. But I know that's not how Becky is.
Well, I've never been, but I live vicariously through Becky's articles. For those who follow, she's been on the show. She has a great article, a couple articles on ProSound Web about this idea of getting on tour and what you should know and all that stuff. So we're here to have the discussion. Chad Olick, you asked and we delivered. So you're our MC. Let's start here. You do tour management. You're responsible for figuring out who's going to be on the tour, who you're going to hire.
Let's be honest. I try not to do tour management. It's very, very rare that I tour manage. I do production manage a lot, though, and it's kind of the same thing in that respect. So for me, you know, I mean, we get, I think anybody in this industry that, even if you're not in a management type position, you're going to get questioned and asked 1,000 times, how can I get into this business? What, you know, what kind of qualifications do I need? What kind of, you know, who can I talk to? And for me, the answer is always kind of the same. You got to kind of start at the bottom. You got to kind of start in your local clubs, in your local thing. You're not, you know, the odds of you first tour out being on a bus with trucks and in arenas. I mean, it's happened. I have friends of mine that's how they started, but it's super rare. You know, you got to kind of dig your way up from at least the, you know, lower middle and work your way into it. And a lot of it is pure luck. You know, who did you find? Who did you meet? You know, were you lucky enough to have a mentor type program, or you know, were you the house person at, you know, whatever the local club is, and, you know, a band came through and they kind of took you with them? You know, there's 1,000 ways, and I think everybody that I know has a slightly different story.
I think, you know, the right place, right time thing is such a reality of how this business works, but the flip side of that is that it's possibly be in the right place at the right time and be completely unprepared.
Absolutely.
So, you know, when that opportunity comes, you can still be in a good or a bad position to make the most of that opportunity, and you can still act on the opportunity or not. You know, there are things that people can do to be ready and be prepared and be competent and present themselves in a professional manner that leaves the visiting artist going, gee, this person seems really cool and competent. They did a good job and they were fun to work with. And this is someone that we want to keep in mind and continue talking to. So make the most out of those interactions, even though you don't know when they're going to come up. My first tour was 5 people, 4 people in the band and 1 sound person, and, you know, 1 hotel room, because that's all they could afford, and we were in an E350 van, and so we kind of had to draw straws to see who was going to sleep on the sleeping bag on the floor that night. You know, that's where it was, and that's certainly not glamorous. So when you go, gee, I want to get on tour, like, that's not what people are thinking of, but that was my first touring experience. I learned a lot, probably wouldn't want to do it again. Becky, what was your first touring experience like?
I sort of came in through a different avenue of being the kid at a PA company. So after about a year of applying to everybody I could find in pre-internet, the industry Bible called the White Book, and to very little avail, I came across an advert in the back of a magazine called The Stage for a sound engineer at a London PA company. And I knew I'd done a college course in studio engineering because I didn't know any other way to try and get a foot in the door. So I applied for this job, knew I was totally underqualified, but applied anyway. And they said, yeah, come and have a chat. You are totally underqualified, but we are looking for somebody to sweep the floor and make the tea and clean the cables and load the trucks and drive the van and all that stuff. So that was my entry point into it. And I learned a lot. That my first tour was with that company. So I actually started touring at a pretty decent level. You know, there was a bus and that sort of thing, but I was very much, I'd done sort of probably about 3 or 4 years as the underling at that point, and I was still very much the kid, the spare, when I went out on that tour. So it's, yeah, you can't go thinking that you're going to be walking in off a college course, mixing bands and going straight into arenas because that just ain't going to happen.
It's amazing how many people think that, though. How many people come out of the various schools. I won't call any particular school out by name, but one seems to perpetuate a slightly more than others the type of student that comes out and thinks that they shouldn't have to coil a cable or have to lug gear. They come out thinking that they should be the A-list heavy hitter that is all of a sudden doing the stadium tours. It's not a reality. You're going to get slapped down way more often than not, I feel like, in that situation.
Yeah, I think, I think about the what I was dealing with on my first tour and the snakes with the bad channels, and there's four subs, but two of them are blown out and the other one's out of polarity. And the little analog Mac, and you got to figure out which inputs work that night. So, and I have friends that were coming out of school at the same time. They go in every month at the school, they do this thing where they, have an arena and they go and hang all their motors and put their PA up and they're mixing on a, SD7 or something like that. And I'm really glad that you got experience on all those things. But for the first 10 years of my career after that, I wasn't in the room with that gear. It was, I had a soldering iron in my kit because I had to put the wedges back together. We weren't going to have a show. And so, it's always funny to see that people will come up to front of house when we're doing like a festival or something, and even not on a touring level, but even at the local production company, regional production company level, hey, that looks cool. I want to do what you're doing. Who wouldn't want to be at the helm of a big PA system? That's fun, right? But yeah, here's your first gig. Like, we have 300 XLR cables that smell like beer and they're all tangled up. So you gotta sort that out, and you gotta test them, and then you gotta fix the bad ones. And then here's a razor blade. Go scrape all the gum off the stage. You know what I mean? Like that someone's got to do that, and I know that we all have done that. And so if you're gonna, that's part of it. And I'm very thankful that I have done that, because I'm glad I pulled feeder under a stage and hit my head on the screw jacks and stuff and came out all covered. I'm glad I did that because I understand what's involved in asking someone to do that when I'm running a crew.
I think one of the biggest things I've realized in hindsight is there's not any one, and we would all agree on this, but there's not any one path into touring. I was having a conversation with someone recently, and the advice I was giving is where do you try to contemplate where you want to go in touring. Like, just the concept of, hey, I want to tour is one thing, right? But like, are you looking to be a A-class, B-class, like, and I might say, I'm talking like Beyonce, Lady Gaga, whatever level touring front of house engineer. The path to that is drastically different than being a steady monitor engineer for your B and C level touring acts, which is a very viable career and nothing wrong with that. Versus being a PA.
And you have a much better shot at being able to do that. Even
right,
there, or there being are more jobs doing that,
right? Being a PA fly tech, being a system tech, in other words, like, if you're looking to be a consistent just front of house engineer working directly for the band long term, then your path is go to the clubs, work out your craft, get picked up by an artist who then puts you to the next artist who puts you to the next artist and works that path. If your goal is to be a system tech or fly PA tech, you go bust your ass in a sound company and pay your time. You get out on the shitty tour and you improve. If you want to break yourself into the monitor market, almost the exact same thing. You go to a sound company. Almost always tours aren't carrying monitor engineers, at least the opening acts, right? So you get your chance to cut your teeth there and then eventually make a name for yourself. And then you can break yourself as a freelance monitor engineer. So contemplate where you're trying to go, and then that will help dictate the path of where you're trying to go.
So if you...
That's my opinion, at least.
No, I think I want to talk about now if Chad, are you staffing a tour? And you call me up and you say, hey, I got this tour going out. Are you interested? How does that conversation go? What types of things should people expect to be asked, the availability wise and how to discuss what they should ask for payment and just kind of things that, if you haven't been through that interaction before, how is that going to go for somebody?
Sure. A lot of times, if I'm calling you, I've already got a lot of information, and I probably already know whether I want to hire you or not. Like, I've already done my research. I've already called my friends in the industry that know you. Or if you're new to the industry, you've probably worked at a venue that I've either been through or I know somebody that's been through there. And it's a really small business, as I think we all know. You know, there's, you know, they say 6 degrees of separation, but I bet in this business there's not more than 2 or 3 degrees of separation between any group of people.
Yeah.
And people are pretty straight up. Like, if you send me a resume and you say, hey, call Chris Leonard and talk to him about, you know, how good I am, I will probably never call Chris and ask him how good you are. Because you're saying, you know, in you saying that, I already know he's going to give you a good report. You know, unless he's like, if he's a close personal friend of mine, then, you know, I can maybe get a little more straight up answer out of him.
Right.
But odds are I'm going to kind of go around that and find out, all right, well, you guys did the, you know, whatever, you did the Disturbed tour together. So I'm going to call the Disturbed's tour manager or Disturbed's production manager or the guitar tech or, you know, maybe the fourth person on the lighting crew. You know, and find out how you were to tour with, because at the end of the day, a lot of us can do the job. You know, that none of what we do is really rocket science. You know,
there's, except what Michael does. That's rocket science. I'm just saying.
Well, yeah, you know what? With the smart stuff, you're right. That, I take that back. Most of what we do isn't rocket science, and there's, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people that can do the job. The question I need answered is: can I live with this person for 30, 60, 90 days in a 45-foot metal tube, nobody, you know, half the people drinking too much, you know, can we survive in that, you know, in that atmosphere together? And yeah, exactly, Chris. Yeah, yes, I'm with you, sir. But you know, can we survive in that atmosphere together? You know, that to me is a bigger question. You know, I need to know that I can live with this person for an extended period of time without wanting to kill them and without them wanting to kill me.
Attitude is everything. Totally agree with what Chad's saying. It's, I would rather have somebody working with me who is competent and a great human being and easy to get along with and comes together as part of the touring family than someone who's technically brilliant but a total pain and unpleasant or just difficult or drama queen or any of that stuff. Yeah. Attitude is everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had guitar techs on tour that thought they were the artist. You know, they, you know, we can't do a show here. What do you mean you can't do a show here? Tune your stupid guitar, shut up, hand it to the guy that's making the money. Like, none of our names are on the marquee. You know, it's, we're not there. You know, if you're in this business for glory for yourself, you're probably gonna have a really hard career of it. You know, I mean, there are people who have semi-transcended, I would say, the backstage life into a more public eye. But if that's your goal, you're definitely on the wrong side and moving in the wrong direction.
How about, I mean, Becky, you've written a whole article about sort of the, I almost want to say, like, they're like the mini logistics of being on the road. You know, like choosing a bunk on the bus and, you know, keep sleeping with your feet forward and you're not allowed to poop on the bus. You know, like stuff that just people you wouldn't know if you hadn't done it. You're not going to find that in a book somewhere. I would like maybe a couple tips from everybody on, or maybe things that they were a surprise to you when you toured and you realized, oh, I didn't realize that it was supposed to be that way. I didn't, you know, I think things that when you look back were an adjustment maybe.
Ooh. Well, the first, I mean, the big two chief rules of touring, yeah, don't poop on the bus and don't sleep with the artist. That would be my number two. Because that way, no. Remember your place. Oh, man. Things that surprised me. God, it's too long ago. I can't remember.
I'll say that I wasn't, the idea of a per diem, if you work at like a local production company or if you haven't toured, that's a new idea.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And it's really easy to go, wow, look at all this money. I'm going to go buy all this. Like, no, it's put that shit in the bank, man. Like, you're going to need that. You know what I mean? It's not, it's there for a reason. It's not so you can go buy an Xbox.
Or is it?
It was for me. I mean, if you're yeah, smart, no. So if you were smart, you know, you could pocket a majority of your per diem on tour. And at the other, if you could save even $100 a week of your per diem, and you know, over a 2-3 month tour, I mean, that's a considerable amount of cash you're walking home with, if you can handle it that way.
Well, for taking it home though, yeah, you don't try to spend it all every day, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You have that, keep that. Wait,
that's not what hotel bars are for. I mean,
oh, you know what would be a big one, actually, thinking about it, will be just taking care of your partying on the road, because you can't be getting into it big time every night and then showing up the next day. You know, if you do that too many times, showing up hungover, not able to do your job properly, expecting other people to pick up the slack, you're not going to last very long. You know, we all like to have a few drinks and stuff, but I would suggest keeping that for the day before a day off. So do it on your own time.
Roadie Friday.
Exactly, Roadie Friday.
Yeah. The Roadie Friday is the perfect day. You know, Roadie Saturday, or Roadie Sunday, really, because there's never a Roadie Saturday. You get a Friday and a Sunday. Yeah.
And, you know, once you get over about 30, it hurts too much to work on a hangover anyway.
Well, that's what's funny to me. I was thinking about, you know, we were sleeping on floors and on couches and shit. Like, oh, my cousin Fred lives in town. We don't need to get a hotel tonight. We'll all stay in his basement. Like, I don't want to do that shit now. Like, that works when you're 19 or 20, you know what I mean? But, like, no, I want to sleep on a bed. I want to be well rested. So,
preferably by myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Another, nobody's your keeper on tour. So, like, you know, it's your responsibility to wake up, you know, in the morning. Like, no one's going to come to your bunk and be like, you know, yo, dude, get up. It's time to go to work. Like, no. Like, that's, you know, that's on you. That type of thing. Like, cleanliness on the top of the bus. I mean, yes, people are going to get on you for it. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be your responsibility. Like, hey, you know, that just that mutual respect of where you're living is...
Yeah, absolutely. Deal. And I think something, I mean, if we're going to go all the way back to like the beginning, so to speak, and you know, the first days in vans or really the first days on buses, I don't know, hopefully this doesn't sound too like condescending, but you don't need to bring a sleeping bag with you. You know, they do provide blankets. If you like your own pillow, bring your own pillow, but they do have pillows.
Don't touch the thermostat.
Don't ever touch the thermostat. It should never go above, in my opinion, 55, but in reality, probably upper 60s.
Yeah, you must be friends with my dad, Chad, because he feels similarly about the house. Yeah.
Yeah. I am a dad, and the thermostat in my house very rarely cracks 67. But another thing that I think we all... Well, some people still do. I've got touring friends that have been touring for 20, 30 years or longer, and they still do this. Pack too much. You know, the person who brings the ginormous hockey duffel plus a giant rolling on and plus a backpack, I was like, man, you could literally send out your laundry on most tours every day. And on the bigger tours, a lot of times there'll be washer and dryer available for you nearly every day. I'm to the point now where the next tour, I may bring just two changes of clothes because we have a washer and dryer with us, and I may just wash every day, just wash yesterday's clothes and just go. I already travel super small. I travel with a backpack and a rolling bag. My rolling bag is my computer, my office type stuff. My backpack is seven shirts, seven socks, seven underwear, and three pairs of shorts, and that's it.
I always have an extra pair of socks in my Pelly, though, because one thing that I've learned about myself is if my socks are wet, I am just absolutely miserable. So that the emergency socks is good. And I'll also say this, something that I kind of found is particularly on like longer festival days and stuff like that, I have to be very proactive and disciplined, making sure that I'm drinking regularly, drinking water, like granola bars, like I have to keep, because it's easy to go 6 or 7 hours without eating if you're not paying attention and you get into something, you're trying to fix something, and that's not going to work long term. You can't do that every day. So I had to learn to take care of myself in that way and make sure I took 30 seconds to stop and have a snack and just have some water and stuff like that.
Something I ran into early on was, not eating or drinking healthy, you know, on the road. You know, it's, again, I was younger when I was touring, so it's pretty much just straight Mountain Dew all day, every day type of thing, you know. it was eye-opening when, and I know this is a luxury thing, on one of the tours, like, we had a masseuse, and, you know, like, or like they would have a masseuse each town, and you, like, a pay-by-the-minute type of thing. You go in there for 15, 20 minutes, just get adjusted. And she was like, man, your back's, like, really tense. She's like, do you drink a lot of caffeine? I'm like, yeah. She's like, yeah, well, you should probably ease off on that. You know, it was a simple, like, adjustment of, like, not being as tense and stuff. And it's, you know, you don't, when you're younger, and this isn't like a, you know, hey kid thing, you know, it's just, you don't think about this. You're just constantly pounding energy drinks, Mountain Dew. You don't really need that. I'm still speaking to myself, by the way. I'm still a 5-hour energy monster every now and then type of thing kind of guy. So, I'm still speaking to myself here. So don't feel like I'm just calling other people out. Just taking care of yourself, you know, people would say to me like, oh, stop jumping off the stage and kill your knees. I'm like, yeah. Okay. I'm getting closer to 40 now, and yes, my knees are hurting. You know, like, it's, and I used to be the guy who was like, I get it, old guy, I get it. Yes, I know. Yes, my knees are now hurting, you know. Like, just take care of yourself. This is a long haul thing, right? This isn't don't grind it out and kill yourself.
No, absolutely. You do have to take care of yourself. And I can speak from personal experience. I did Ozfest, several Ozfest tours, and at the end of Ozfest 2000, I was out with an artist. We were in Philadelphia, and I had massive pain in my back, and I couldn't figure out. This is, you know, Ozfest had just ended. We had just started a tour opening for Stone Temple Pilots, and I had this just massive pain in my lower back, and I couldn't figure it out. It got worse and worse to the point where I finally had to call my tour manager, and he had to get me an ambulance, take me to the hospital. Turns out I had a kidney stone. Well, I just spent the entire summer drinking nothing but soda and Gatorade. The whole summer. Oh, yeah. You know, I don't know that I had a bottle of water in 3 months of summer heat. You know, and that's just, I mean, it's pure stupidity on my part. I figured Gatorade, you know, it's hydrating. It's, you know, it's good for you. You know, I mean, I wasn't drinking a ton of alcohol, you know, or, well, no more so than, you know, I'd say average. You know, but yeah, just... you do need to take care of yourself, water especially, maybe even more than the food side. Make sure you drink plenty of water. But the food is definitely a big thing. It's hard to survive on McDonald's and Taco Bell forever.
Just Taco Bell. Well, Becky, a lot of the work that you do, the idea of taking care of yourself from a mental angle, I'll share that. There was a point when I was on tour and I was, you know, backstage somewhere, and I just had this moment. I got totally disoriented, and I was like, I don't even know where I am in the country right now. I just, you know, because it can turn into a blur. You know, you wake up and you're in a different place. And so I had a moment where I was just really disoriented. And so I try to just spend a little time every morning kind of just getting acquainted with myself and, you know, look at the day sheet. I know where I am, you know, just spend some time to kind of, you know, it's their temptation to just get up and just be off like a shot and be going, but just take a kind of moment and just get myself centered and prepared for the day before I go off. So I was hoping you could talk about that a little bit, Becky, because I know you do a lot of work like that.
Yeah, definitely you need to have a few little kind of touchstone things that help you to take care of your mental health. I mean, for me, I'm really hot on trying to get outside into daylight every day. We spend, if you're doing anything other than a festival tour, you are likely in artificial light or darkness for most of your life, and that's not how humans are supposed to be. So any chance I can get, even if it's, you know, just standing outside the back door for 10 minutes and just, you know, seeing daylight, or ideally, you know, finding half an hour to go for a walk after sound check or something like that. You know, you've got a double whammy then of some daylight and a bit of exercise that's not pumping boxes and loading trucks. That for me is huge. That really helps my mental state. And same thing in the mornings. You know, I'm fortunate. I don't start at the, you know, kind of production or rigging call of 6 a.m. or whatever. But I do still get up early, and I'll maybe take myself into, if we're in a town, I'll go get a coffee and just have some personal time. And you know, my thing is I like to get on my yoga mat for, you know, a little while before I take a shower. But, you know, whatever works for you, but carve out a little bit of time for yourself to be in daylight and just do something that's not related to the gig, because you need to kind of stay sane.
in that same process, I'm curious, both from Becky and Chad, something I experienced, anybody in the live production world, I think, experiences, right? We go through either a massive show, we're living on this euphoria, utopia thing, the adrenaline, or we're on this long tour, and we come home, and that all comes to a crashing stop. That's something where it wasn't until after a tour or two or three that I realized I was able to retrospectively reflect of like, there's this mental state crash of like, of feeling alone or just, you don't know what it is because it's, you've lived on this adrenaline, and then it's gone. Have you guys experienced that? And, or do you actively now think about what that looks like returning to, air quotes, normalcy here, or home life as opposed to road life, and how to kind of balance that transition and mentally change your mind?
I think it's a tough one. I feel like we could all do with a sort of some sort of decompression center where we can all go for a few days at the end of a tour. It's a big one because you've had this ready-made community of like-minded people who there's this kind of tribe thing that you know we don't have to explain. Even if we've only just met, we know what each other's lives, working lives at least, are like. We don't have to explain this very large part of what makes us. And you go home and you go, it's great to go hang out with your home friends and things, but they don't generally understand what it is you've just been experiencing. And it's tough. I think for me the main thing is just to be aware that it is going to be tough for the first couple of weeks, and just to have patience with myself and just be a little bit kind to myself and not expect myself to leap straight back into knowing how to go to the supermarket and cook dinner. It's like, okay, you know what? It's going to be takeouts the first few nights.
Yeah, and we should give a shout out to the Roadie Clinic, Paul and Courtney, and everything that they're doing, because they are really setting up to help people with this type of thing. I mean, you talk about people that get home and they can't sleep because they're not on a bus. You know, they're still and it's quiet and they're not being shaken, and so that can be an adjustment in a lot of ways. That's definitely something that we want people to be aware that the stuff like the Roadie Clinic is out there. And they're set up to help people work through that stuff. So definitely want to give them a shout out as well.
Yeah, and for me, maybe I'm broken. I'm not really sure. When I come home, I actually jump straight back into being home. I used to try and take a few days to decompress and readjust, but I found that didn't work for me. For me personally, that made it worse. Like trying to be by myself or trying to whatever. It just didn't work. So for me, I have my wife and my daughter. So as soon as I come home, I immediately become dad and husband again. And, I do a fair portion of the cooking when I'm home. So I'm back to planning meals and cooking dinners. And, for me, I think mentally for me, that's the easiest way for me to adjust, is literally just to kind of jump in and do it. The only trouble I really have is with sleep when I get home. And it's just like Michael just said, I have trouble without the bus sound, so it takes me a good 2 or 3 weeks before I get a regular sleep pattern again. That plus, working 18 to 22 hours a day, you just get used to not sleeping.
So Chad, I'm curious, as being a production manager and having to kind of run the crew, drive the crew, what are some constant pet peeves you would have from people? So kind of, maybe new to the touring industry and like, daily occurrences of things that you have to kind of manage on a day-to-day basis.
Don't poop in the artist's dressing room ever. Would be one of the first ones. I fired two people for that. Fairly recent. Well, I mean, I say recently, nothing is recent anymore, but fairly recently. It goes back to being good to other people. At the end of the day, we all have to live with each other. We don't have to necessarily truly like each other. There are definitely people that I would rather not tour with, and I'm sure I am definitely not super high on other people's touring. I want to go tour with that guy. I'm sure I'm pretty low on some of their lists, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, if I'm stuck with these people or they're stuck with me, we still have to get along. We still have to do the job. So be pleasant to one another. Don't, if I hear people calling people out over the dumbest shit, which we've all seen at one point or another, or the nitpicking and the, you know, the, I don't know, the just the super overly, I mean, we work in a juvenile business, but the overly juvenile way sometimes people act is, it can be a little much, and it'll definitely, for me, it'll put you on my bad side, and I'll be watching for a reason to get rid of you.
How about egos? How often do are egos
constantly? I mean, this business is full of egos, myself included. I'm sure, you know, in this business, I feel like you almost have to have a bit of an ego to survive and to excel. You have to, or at least strong confidence. Maybe ego is not quite the right word. And sometimes being confident can come across as having a big ego. And I've met people that are both ways. I've met people that have ginormous egos and they're a pain in the ass to work with and I wouldn't want to hire them. And like Becky said earlier, I would rather take someone who's kind of mediocre at their job, but an amazing person to live with than somebody who is the best possible person to that job, but is just a raging dick all the time. You know, it just, quality of life has to matter at some point, you know, and we can't just say, oh, I'm making great money, so I'll just deal with it. You know, I'd rather not make great money and not deal with it.
How about the idea of, depending on the level of tour you're on, people at some point in their career potentially get to kind of a white glove situation, or close to it, you know? That could be an interesting dynamic for, like, the newbie on tour who has to interface with that person have you had to deal, it's my question for Becky and Chad, have you had to deal with any type of like white glove situation, the dynamics that creates on the rest of the crew and animosity maybe at all, or is that typically handled well?
Becky, why don't you go first? Because my story might take a second.
I've certainly come across like people who are, you know, fresh out of the box, it's their first tour, and they're not understanding why, say, the front of house engineer has just packed up their gear and wheeled it to a holding place to go on the truck. Now, that's not white gloving. That's, you know, that's that this person is setting up and pulling down their own gear. But the new person is not understanding why they're not putting it on the truck. It's like, well, you know, they've done 30, 40 years or so of their, you know, they've done their truck loading, and now it's your turn, right. Grasshopper. Off you go.
Yeah, and white gloving's relative. I mean, like, you know, often at least, you know, some of the elite engineers, if you will, you know, they'll at least pack up their console at front of house, you know. But yes, they're not worried about flying the PA, and they're not worried about pushing substacks to the trucks. They're not wrapping snakes, things like that, you know. So I know that can be, you know, for some, like, you know, why aren't you sharing your load? But yeah, I think very quickly after a tour or two, you kind of realize, you know, where that stuff sits.
And personally, I don't find that to be, if you're packing up your console, like as a front of house engineer, like for me as a front of house engineer, I'll pack up my console. If we need help with other stuff, I'm always willing to help with other stuff. But at the end of the day, my responsibility is my console, my racks, whatever I have, possibly the microphones on stage, depending on what your deal is with the monitor engineer and the, you know, and any of the techs. I don't consider that white gloving. I did have a front of house engineer. It's very rare that I'm not the front of house engineer on a tour. I've only not been, I think, three times ever. You know, like I don't, mixing is what I like. Production managing is what I do to help pay bills.
Right.
One tour, I went back to an artist who I had been the front of house engineer for. They asked me back to production manage because they had, long story anyway, I had left. It had been a couple of years. They had somebody new who was a great engineer and was doing a great job. But that person was literally a white glove engineer. Show came down. He walked away from his console. He went to the bus. He'd grab a cigar. He'd grab a drink or whatever, which in and of itself can cause some massive animosity between people. But then he would take his folding chair, bring it to the dock, and sit on the dock and smoke a cigar and watch people load the trucks.
No.
So I mean, and this person had the band's ear, so there's no way, you know, nothing I can say is really going to be effective. So I had to tell him, I'm like, just dude, just I understand that you're not going to actually work. You're going to mix your 90-minute show, then you're going to walk away. And that's fine. That's the deal you have. That's the deal you struck. Far be it for me to say anything about that. Don't rub it in the crew's face. You know, go to the bus, hang out near the bus, hang out in the bus. I don't care. You're not to be on the dock. Stay the fuck away from the dock unless you're moving gear.
Well, I don't like being in the way. Because I'm pretty particular about how I pack my rig up, and I want this little cable to go in this. And if it's not there tomorrow, I'm going to have a shit fit. So, I try to extend that. Sometimes when people think they're helping, they're not actually helping me because I want it done a certain way. And so I wouldn't go into someone else's area and do that. So I'm happy to help. I want to make sure people know, hey, you know, I'm done with what I got to do. I can give you a hand, but I'm going to just be like, what, you know, is there something I can do to help? Because I don't want to do that to somebody else where I'm doing stuff the way they don't want it done. That's not going to help anybody.
I just thought about this in talking about sitting on the dock. I was running through my mind of what it was like to push gear to the truck. And one of the things that was good for me early on, that was taught to me early on, we're all about efficiency on tour. Right? Like, you're always, every night, it's like you have a clock, and by the end of the tour, you're trying to shave a half hour or whatever off of your, or hour off of your loadout time, depending on how big your tour is. And one of the things that was efficient for me was on the back of my laminate, I had a piece of gaff tape, or sometimes it could be even more official that, and your truck pack was listed on the back of your laminate. So it, you know, so that you can always reference every night, this is next, this is next, this is next, this is next. Or another key thing for me was a trick I learned early on was put a new piece of gaff tape on the back of my laminate every day. I'd write my crew's name down, because calling people by name every day, I'm awful remembering names, right? But if I can write the names down, I would, that way I could be more personable. You know, people come to loadout and it's like, oh, I still have this person, this person, this person. I can call them by name. Just that little bit of extra confidence in a person's name can go a long way. And that, and then one other little trick in that same vein would be, so one of the things I would do early on when I was touring is when I was home, I would work local shows, working for the union or local stagehands, partially to make a few extra bucks, but really what I was doing was I was trying to put myself in the other shoes. I was trying to put myself in the stagehand shoes, and I encourage anybody who's getting into touring, go do some local union work, put yourself on the other side of the snake, the whatever you want to call it, and feel what it's like to get instructed. But do a couple things when you're doing that. I was seeing different crews, how well, what they communicate. Like, I was, you know, I knew enough. I had been touring, so I knew what I was supposed to do, but I was waiting for them to give me the instructions, and how they were giving the instructions. I would analyze, like, oh, how detailed were they? And then I would try to take that information when I go back on a tour and use that information now that I know what it's like to be on the other side. And one of the earliest things I learned was, like, okay, instructing my crew, if you don't have anything to do, don't just wander around. Everyone, as soon as you're done this project I give you, you come to this spot, whether that's downstage left, whether that's whatever that spot is. You say, all right, if you don't have a task, you come here. And then I come and get you and get you, bring you your next task. Because if you give somebody too many tasks, they're never going to get them done. One task, come to this spot, I'll come get you. Little things like that helped me kind of progress early on.
And I know I said this, I think, Chad, last time you were on the show, I think I said this, but I've been on the receiving end of being the local tech and not been given enough information to do my job, and how shitty that feels and how frustrating it is. And then you have a bad show because of it, or something's not done right and the touring person has to come and redo it. And it's because I wasn't given enough information to do it, or the instructions weren't clear. And so, you know, I don't like how that feels. So when I'm on the other end, I like to, you know, make a point to be clear and to create an environment where someone feels like, yeah, I can ask a question if I didn't understand what he said, or if he used a terminology that I didn't understand. Like, I take that very seriously to make sure that people don't feel like they're getting beat down. They don't feel like they're kind of getting just shoved out there, and they don't have a context for what's happening. I mean, hopefully everyone understands what it's like to be in a production environment, but I don't like how it feels when I'm not given enough information to do my job properly. So I try to be very cognizant about that on the other side.
Mm. I think one of the things that really helps on loadouts, particularly, is, especially if you're on the touring crew, is it's really straightforward, but know where your empties are, especially if you've been somewhere for a couple of days. you know, don't have them scattered around the place. Know where they're going to be, and preferably like have some coloured tape or something on them, so you can say to the locals, "Okay, guys, can you go and get me everything that's got blue tape on that's in that room back there, and bring it here?" You know, it cuts down on, you know, just looking around for dumb shit, like you can't find the wheels to a certain box.
And your stage, hopefully you have a good stage manager, you know, because a lot of times a good stage manager will solve all those problems kind of for you. You know, he may not fix it, but he'll know where the fix is.
Becky, when you were saying that, I was laughing because we did this show a while ago, and there was a local guy there, and the stage manager said, there was like, you know, pipe and drape pipes, and he said, "Hey, can you take these pipes out into the stairwell?" And he does. And he doesn't come back. He just went into the stairwell because he didn't say "and then come back afterwards." And so I was like, we always laugh about that because it's kind of what you said, Chris. But don't assume that your instructions were clear to the person that you gave them to. I guess that's a goofy story, but it makes me laugh. So I figured I'd tell it, you know.
Yeah, I have had somebody try and take all the tape off of the snake before now. That was I was like, "Where have they gone?" And I was like, saw them about halfway up the room, go, "What are you?" No, I mean, okay, my bad. I should have said that wasn't what I meant. I assumed too much prior knowledge.
I had someone disassemble a drum snake.
Oh man, really?
Yeah, somebody disassembled the entire drum loom. Every cable was nicely coiled, and I mean, they did a good job. You know, they coiled the cables nice and everything, but yeah, all whatever 15, 16 cables all nicely coiled at the riser. When I got up there, I'm like, "Man, you're fucking fast." Like, I wasn't even 10 minutes, you know, like,
I'm not even mad, actually.
You're wrong, but you're fast.
Yeah. It's like, "Well, you did a great job. Sucks for us tomorrow, but you did a great job. Thanks."
A hard thing for me early on was learning how to delegate work, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, typically your first couple of tours, you were like a stage jammer, stage patch type of person or PA fly tech. And you feel like, especially as like a company guy, like, you know, "I just got to do this. Like, I'll be able to do it faster if I do it." I had a couple of production managers, tour managers really push me in that area, or stage managers, depending on, again, another thing you'll learn, depending on the size and scale of your tour, the scope of a stage manager, PM, or tour manager, it bleeds. But I had, you know, PMs and TMs, stage managers push me to like, "Hey, you need, I don't care if the next three cities it takes you longer to get it done, you need to push yourself, because what it'll do is it's communication skills. Like, you have to learn how to better delegate." In other words, you're probably, if you think that the stage manager is getting done quick enough, it maybe you're not explaining it well enough, or it's not labeled well enough, or your system's not down well enough. So it'll push you to develop that system better, which ultimately make you better and more efficient. So getting over that hurdle of delegation was a big thing for me early on.
Well, the other part of that, Chris, I think that I overlooked for too long is that I don't need to put hands on every case when it comes in. There are people there for that. I need to, you know, I was doing so much myself that by the time the show actually started, I was absolutely beat. And I was like, "No, I have to mix the show still." You know what I mean? I have to make sure that all stuff gets back on the truck. I have to look after the artist. There are so many things that I have to do, and I was trying to do it all myself, and that's not helping anybody, because if I'm exhausted or I try to lift something that I shouldn't be lifting myself and I get hurt, like that, I am not helping the production at that point. So it's not a white glove thing, but on the other hand, you also don't have to do everything yourself. Let the people who are there to move the gear with you and for you, and let them help and let them do their jobs, because usually if I'm getting that granular, I'm probably not paying attention to something that I should be paying attention to on a different front. So, you know, not totally burning myself out by 4 p.m. and letting the people that were there to help was something that was a lesson for me.
How about, so what, you know, we all know the crux of this is don't be an asshole, right? So, in general, in life, whatever, right? You know, Chad already alluded to how small this industry is, right? If you're touring, you know, even arena, theater level tours, you're going to hit the same venues 2 to 3 times in a year, which means you're going to see the same stagehands 2 to 3 times a year. And they're going to remember you whether you remember them or not. Becky, can you maybe speak to what that is like over the years of those relationships and how maybe that's paid off of, like, you not being an asshole? Because I'm assuming you've made it this far in your career, you're probably not an asshole.
I try not to be. I'm sure I have my moments, but I do try very hard not to be. Yeah, I mean, when you've been touring for a while, like you say, you come across the same people again and again as local hands. If you've treated them with respect and you've, you know, helped them to feel valued in as much as you're letting them do their jobs and giving them enough information to be able to help you, you can actually develop quite a nice relationship where, you know, it's, you see somebody again, you haven't seen them for 6 months or whatever, it's, you know, you have a nice little chat and they want to come work with you because they know you and they know they're going to get properly, you know, treated with respect and not be an asshole. And yeah, it's this whole industry is so much about relationships. I mean, all industries are, it's all humans at the end of the day, but our industry in particular is so much about relationships that, you know, bonus points if you can remember somebody's name, but you know, it's huge just to have people think well of you, because you never know who you're talking to. You know, you should treat everybody from, you know, the artist to you know, the guy that's taking out the bins at the venue, the same. So everyone deserves that respect and for you to be kind.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And while you were talking, there was a story that I was like, oh, I have to mention the story. And now I focused again on the rest of the stuff that you're saying, and now the story has left me. So I'm sure it'll come back. But I remember, probably 10 years ago, I think we were at Paramount Theater in Seattle, and there was a stagehand there named Brooksy. And for whatever reason, I'm like, yeah, this is my dude. And like, he was just kind of my guy for the whole day, you know? And I still remember that guy that, you know, we had a great time working together, and he would just got me what I needed and you know, did what we needed to do. And like, I absolutely remember that. I remember a lot of festivals where I remember the house System Tech. I mean, those things do stick with you when you have a really good day. Oh, or okay, now this is what jogged my memory of. I was the house tech for a band coming in, and the engineer was not at all open about input list even. I didn't even get an input list. I was like, well, I can't wire your stage ahead of time. Usually, you know, we're gonna do as much as we can, so when you show up you can just go, wouldn't give me an input list, wouldn't give me anything, and ran every cable himself on the stage, which is fine. You want to you do it the way you want to do it. I'm here to help you in whatever capacity you want. But then we get to line check and nothing's coming up in the right spot, and he starts getting mad at me. And I said, no, you wouldn't give me any information all day. You didn't let me touch any of my own kit here, so I'm sorry, but I can't help you with this. You need to sort it out yourself because you got yourself into this position. So, you know, that was frustrating for me. And I'm sure it was frustrating for him. And so that's solved by just, you know, giving your coworkers for the day, your colleagues for the day, a little bit of professional respect and you know, at least give them the benefit of the doubt. And if someone's royally fucking it up, then I'll jump in and go, you know what, I'll sort this out. Thank you. But, you know, that could have been prevented by just saying, yeah, here's our input list or here's what we're trying to do. You can still do it yourself, but at least let me know what's going on. So when there's a problem, I can help you. That's my job. If I'm the house tech, you're in my venue, my job is to help you work through those problems that you're going to encounter, and I wasn't able to do that. And everyone else on the show that day saw that happening, and that just kind of was just weird for everybody. So those are the things that, yeah, let's have a dialogue about this. Let's have some professional respect, and let's just figure out what we're trying to do here, and let's do it, you know?
I was just thinking about the difference between union crews in the States and crews in other parts of the world. That might be an interesting thing to talk about, because that was something that was a surprise to me. The first time I toured America was, say, Madison Square Gardens, wasn't allowed to touch my gear at all. And I did find that frustrating. And you're not going to buck the system. So that could be an interesting thing to hear you guys' perspective about that, because it varies from town to town where you are, right?
Well, I'd rather abstain.
I'll go there. I have no problem. So, yeah, it's it was an eye-opening thing. Like, so, I mean, you know, first off, obviously, Madison Square Garden, for those who don't know, is a completely different ballgame. Just even your average Union venue, right? You know, so some Union venues you'll have one Union you're dealing with, maybe two. At the Garden, you're talking three, four different unions. Like, specifically the Garden, you know, you have Teamsters on your truck. You have IBEW, who does electrics and audio facing the audience, but not audio facing the stage. And your PA has to go up a different elevator than everyone else has to go up. You know, IA takes anything that happens on the stage. They get to go up the ramp, which I've heard, actually, now that's all changed. But anyway, at least when I was there, I had to load, I don't know, 80, 100 some vertic up a tiny little elevator up in Madison Square Garden, and while everything else was getting forked up the ramp.
Now we took the entire.
That is a completely different dynamic than other places. Regardless of what you do or don't feel about unions and stuff, it's one of those things like you're not going to change the system. And going back to just that relational thing, like the expectation of knowing what you're going to go into and just running with it, you know, if you try to buck the system into whatever town you're in, you're going to fail. You know, you have to kind of play the game. And this is where, like, hey, you know, if you're people, the first time they've never seen you before, they're going to push your buttons and test you, right? If you don't crack and you can play the game and you can, you know, be a decent human being, they'll remember that. And the next time it'll get easier. You'll notice that in some cities, the unions, you can push whatever you want. And look, everyone I've ever met is all about, as long as you have an honest conversation, either with the steward or with direct hands, like, hey, just, and I'll be frank, like, hey, what's it like here today? What can I do? What can I do? As long as you have the conversation, you're going to be fine. If you don't have the conversation, assume what you can and can't do, that's going to be an issue. And this is not, I don't know if any of that came off as negative towards unions. It's not. Are there negative experiences? Sure, sometimes. Are there negative experiences with, you know, Crew One in Atlanta who are non-stage hands or whatever other city? By the way, I'm not calling out Atlanta. I'm just saying, like, just naming local labor brokers that I know the name of off the top of my head. all hate mail goes to College Train Side. What I learned through the years was just, again, if you hold yourself with respect, you respect the human, you give people respect until they don't deserve it, and then we'll have a problem. You know, and let your, and Chad could probably speak to this, know your place. Let your PM or your stage manager deal with that issue. Don't take it onto yourself. If you're having issues, don't deal with it yourself. Take it to your PM, because that PM typically probably has a 10-plus year relationship with that steward or whatever, and can probably deal with it way more head-on than you can by dealing with this one asshole who just signed up on the union or local crew of whatever labor broker 2 days ago. So, Chad, you maybe have any insight on that relationship side there?
And that's absolutely true, I'll continue to use the Garden as an example, because it can be the toughest or one of the toughest buildings in the world to do a show in if you're not on the right side of people. And I've been very fortunate in my career. My stage manager for the last three or four trips to the Garden has an amazing relationship with the steward there. And I mean, it's not like we get away with anything or do anything anybody else can't do. But he's got such a great relationship with the steward that it's a smooth and easy day every time. It's perfectly smooth, and we don't have to bring the speakers up the elevator. It all comes up the ramp on the forks.
That was years ago,
right?
But before, I mean, yeah.
To speak to the there can be, sadly, at times there can be an us versus them kind of mentality when it comes to local labor, whether it be union or Crew One or I had the other name, the other big one.
Rhino,
yes, sorry, yeah. Was the other one I was thinking of. I mean, there can definitely be an us versus them mentality, which I wish there wasn't. And I don't even know half the time if it's our people that start it or their people that start it. Yeah, I really don't know.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's both.
But they can make your day a living hell, Or they can make your day very smooth. Like I said, I've been very fortunate to have nothing but smooth days at the Garden, where I know a lot of people that pray they never go back because, you know, they've had just such a hard time there. For me, I'll do the Garden every night. It takes longer to get in and out, but at the end of the day, it's still a smooth day. You know, the only issue I ever had there was we had put on a tour, we had put some lighting on top of the PA grid. So there was a big argument between IBEW and IOTC as to who had to plug in those lights because they're electric, but they're on top of PA. So the two departments, nobody would touch it. So eventually I just walked up and plugged in the two cables. I was like, see, look, it's done. All right. You guys don't have to fight anymore. We're good. Yeah. And we kind of knew going into myself and the production designer joked, we're like, when this gets to the Garden, this could be interesting. We'll see how it goes. And it was fine for us. You know, there was no problem with any of our people. It was just their people kind of bickering back and forth. That's your job. No, that's your job. Mm-hmm. Kind of crap. But yeah, you know, they're there to help you and you're there to get them, you know, a job. Yeah, that's their job is to help you, and your job at the end of the day is to hopefully instruct them well. And I find a lot of times they don't get instructed well. That is, especially you know, when it gets to, and I don't mean to call out backline people, but they seem to be guilty more often than other departments of the they messed up my stuff. Well, you didn't really tell them what to do, how to do it, where to put it. You know, you just told them to take the lids off the cases. That's exactly what they did. They took the lids off the cases. Right, you can't find your lids because you didn't tell them where to put them. You know, you gave no further instruction other than unlid these cases. You know, so it does come down to, you know, a bit to that. And to your point, Chris, earlier about, you know, what you should do if you're having a problem, absolutely do not deal with it yourself. Unless you're the PM or TM, go to the PM or TM or stage manager. Maybe hit the stage manager first. You know, that would be the proper.
It depends on the tour. Like
But speaking at like a Garden level, you know, you go to your stage manager first. If the stage manager doesn't solve it, you go to the PM. I don't think it ever really needs to escalate above the PM. You know, if he can't solve it, there's a fair chance it can't be solved in the 10 hours that you're in the building. Yeah, at that point, just suck it up and deal with it. You're going to be out of there at, you know, as somebody that's not on the production side of things, you'll be out of there by midnight. You know, go to the bus, have a beer, and relax. You know, forget about it.
I got a quick question to think about this. So we almost always hear about front of house PM, TM sharing. Mm-hmm. Have either of you ever heard of a monitor engineer who actually shares both those roles? Like a monitor engineer and a PM, monitor engineer and TM?
I have, but it's not often. That position is, like the monitor position's too busy all day long, I feel like, to properly do either job. Even like, I mean, for me with Fall Out Boy, I'm the PM front of house, but I can only do that because I have a great assistant and I have a great stage manager. If I didn't do that, if I didn't have a great assistant and a great stage manager, there's no friggin' way on earth I could do both jobs. With my stage manager,
I didn't realize actually that you did Fall Out Boy. It's kind of ironic that we replaced Kyle with you, and he's from former Fall Out Boy anyway.
He is, yes, yeah. So
squirrel.
We're 1 degree of separation on Fall Out Boy. There's one gentleman between us. Kyle and I have talked about that before. We've known each other. Oh God, almost 20 years now. But on that tour, my stage manager, possibly even more than my production coordinator, really saves me on that tour because I don't have to deal with, and he won't let me deal with the stage and the trucks. If I show up at the stage and trucks, I get yelled at. You know, I'm fucking up his thing. I'm getting in his way. You know, he's got his way of, he wants to do it, and far be it for me to get in the way because he does it well. You know, so without that, there's no way at the level we tour. Our last tour was 13 trucks, you know, with two floating stages and a thrust that went literally from one end of the building to the other. There's no way I could do that and as a production manager and mix the show without an amazing team. And I think as a monitor engineer, I don't know, Becky, you're a monitor engineer. You'd be able to speak more than I could to this, but I can't see that being really feasible.
Yeah, that makes sense to put in that context.
I think there's too much going on at a critical, I'm just trying to think if it would be, I can't say it be possible because, maybe monitor engineers are a country club and, you know, get to come in a little bit later, but it's so busy from that critical point from when you come in sort of like 9:30, 10 o'clock through to after sound check, you are totally absorbed in what you're doing. So I'm sure there are people who've done it, but no, I wouldn't see it being an easy thing to
do. That's fair. So I know we're kind of coming out of our time, and Becky, we've had you on before, Chad, we've had you on before, but I have a new 2021 question, so let's get this out with both of you. Becky, I want to start with you. If you could define your legacy, what would it be?
I would like to think I've raised awareness of staying healthy on the road. And I don't think of myself as a female sound engineer, but, you know, let's call it like it is. That's what I am. And I would like to think I've inspired some younger women to see that, you know, there is space for all of us on the road.
That's awesome. Mm. Love it. Chad?
Before I answer, I'd like to say the same thing with Becky. There, you know, it'd be great to see a little more diversity in our business. And not necessarily, you know, I mean, a lot of women, I don't know what drives them into this position, whether it's, you know, the production coordinator, wardrobe, blah, 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 to use the air quotes, the typical female jobs on the road. I would love to see more people branch out into backline, audio, lighting. And I'm not sure what doesn't let it blossom as much, or maybe it's just me not seeing it. I don't know. But before I get to my answer to your question, Chris, I would love to see more of that and see more of a way to get that. And to answer your question, Chris, for my legacy, I hope people think I did a fairly good job at my job. And, I know I can be a raging asshole at times, but I hope people think I was not a raging asshole more often than I was.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you both for joining us. It's always a pleasure to talk to both of you. I really appreciate having you on. And I'm sure like I said, we have no shortage of people reaching out to us who want to get on the road and want to know what it's like to tour. And I'm sure they will glean a lot of helpful information from listening to you guys talk and share your experiences. So we really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Gladly. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for having us.